When I was a child, I put away childish things. Now abideth faith, hope, love. And the greatest of these is...
Paul to open.
Paul to open.
Yes, and what do you do?
We have seen hell.
Oh, dear, dear.
What is it?
The curse of Fenrir.
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 A natural source of lethal poisons.
Come, I'll show you it all.
Here come the drums!
Hello, 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 and welcome to Pull to Open, the ongoing quest to watch all of Doctor Who, even the very bad bits, in completely random order. My name's Chris Taylor.
And I'm Pete Paschal. I wonder why Chris framed it that way. Very interesting. Nice little digression.
Yeah.
Oh, guys.
I'm tipping my hand there. Or...
A little bit.
Yeah.
You might be revealing that we are a cursed podcast. And
it's
as
totally
a cursed podcast, we are very familiar with curses. The thing about curses is you eventually have to deal with them. You need you have to either be accept that you're cursed forever or have to excise the curse somehow. So perhaps a little of that will be happening today. But
that's
before
right.
we excise our curses.
Well, we should sort of quickly catch listeners up because
exactly.
A lot of listeners don't know about our seaborne curse that may become relevant today. But yeah, we made a mistake at one point in our journey where we were supposed to go to the Curse of the Black Spot. And we
I'm glad you've said we. Because we're a team podcast.
Exactly. Make mistakes as a team, and you know it's fine, it's all good. It just means that we're cursed. Nothing wrong with that. Just meant that we had to go to a lot of pirate stories for a while, and now apparently we're going to the only other Doctor Who story with a curse in the title. But we'll get there. We'll get there. But Pete,
not the only other.
Okay, so that helps preserve the mystery, Pete. Why don't you catch the fine folks up on our random journey recently?
Well, previously on Pull to Open, we were escaping something. It wasn't a curse, but it was a group of goofy Daleks. They were in their own time machine, which was surprisingly competent. It was a great machine. It was actually much better able to be steered than the TARDIS, but... Never mind that. Let's actually never talk about that again. That was three stories ago in the chase. But
otherwise
we wanted
the
to do
of the TARDIS. Yes.
Well, what we didn't realize at the time that this was the first in a Dalek trilogy in Pull to Open. So right from the chase, the randomizer took us to a John Pertwee adventure.
Yes.
I almost said well-remembered, oft-remembered. I don't think it's either of those things, but it is
an
remembered.
Occasionally remembered story.
Occasionally remembered story for the Daleks not being able to shoot anyone for about half an episode before they equipped themselves with some machine guns. This was, of course, Death to the Daleks. And
yes.
The less said about that one, the better, probably. I think we should. It's kind of like one of those trilogies where the middle part is just kind of filler.
Yeah.
And
It was kind of cursed.
A little bit.
It was cursed. And by the way, there was a watery curse going on in the chase.
Oh, yes.
With the Marie Celeste. So
definitely cursed the Daleks.
Yeah, and there was definitely, I felt like there was a curse on the Daleks in Death to the Daleks, my goodness.
Mm. Well, and then there was an ancient curse that bubbled up from the sewers to the Dalek City in the last part of our trilogy where we attacked the Magician's Apprentice and the Witch's Familiar. All one story, of course, the Series 9 opener for Capaldi. A lot of weighty things to get in there with Dalek lore and Davros and the Master slash Missy.
Arguably, the curse of the hybrid began there.
Yeah.
A curse on the entire Dalek race, infected now with regeneration energy, thanks to the Doctor.
Surprisingly, with so many bad guys in that one, no one yells curses at the end. So...
Alas.
Has anyone actually done that in Doctor Who, come to think of it? I know Joe Grant does it ironically once. We can count that. We can count that. But that's it. We're done. We're done with Daleks, maybe for a while, maybe until next week. We don't know, but what we're dealing with now certainly is curses, and one curse in particular, and it's from Season 26, Serial 3, The Curse of Fenric.
Yes. Now, The Curse of Fenric, as you may know, even if you're not a fan of the Sylvester McCoy Doctor, is kind of widely regarded as one of his best. I think that's fair to say, Pete. Right?
It's funny you say that, because I happen to have the recent Doctor Who magazine that polls everyone, or rather the fans, for what are the best stories in every Doctor's run. And I have it here. I can't really see myself very well. But yes, the number two spot right after Remembrance of the Daleks is, in fact, The Curse of Fenric. So it is regarded in fans' minds, at least.
And that's unchanged
by McCoy standards.
Yeah, that's unchanged from the 2014 poll, when it was second to Remembrance of the Daleks.
Yeah, it's always been up there, I think. Yeah. Actually, that has the previous ones. Yeah, it's always been two. It's always been number two. Remembrance has always been number one.
Yeah, so I was kind of looking forward to this one. I should say that I've tried to watch Curse of Fenric before. I have a whole issue with McCoy. We got into that. If you watch or listen to the rage quitting episode, we talked about my rage quitting at the very beginning of the McCoy era. So
wait a minute. You hadn't seen this before?
What I had done was I'd watched episode one of The Curse of Fenric about three times.
I get it. Say no more. I get it.
So confused that I couldn't get any further. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to get into all of it. We're not just episode one, but two, three, and four, and the story as a whole. Also, as part of speaking of trilogies, the Ace trilogy, which is the second part of, not filler, I will just say. But before we get into any of that, I want to tell everyone, guys, if you're not on YouTube, why aren't you on YouTube, or at least following us on YouTube? We're at youtube.com/poll2open. Yes, let's wave to the folks who can see us. And if you're on Spotify video podcast, that's a good place to see us too. But on YouTube, all the action is really happening. There's a lot of great discussion happening on the podcast. And we now have a membership program, everyone. If you haven't heard, you can also become a true companion of poll2open. Yes, you can essentially subscribe to the podcast, not just with your time and intention, but with those satsumas in your pocket, those dollars, the whatever currency you have, will accept it all. But it's $7.99 per month. You can pledge your support to the podcast, and with that subscription, you will get the podcast a day early. You get it Fridays, folks. Maybe even earlier some weeks if I get to the edit.
It's the opposite of a curse, really.
Yeah,
you get the blessing of early pull to open, which is fabulous. You will know all about the Curse of Fenric in this instance, or you would have known all about it a day ago. Wouldn't that have made your day better? Anyway, so
absolutely,
that's where you get to be in a true companion situation, but you can pay a little more. And yes, that's right, we will actually make you a British aristocrat. We're one of those outfits that sells a Viscount title for you. You can go around and call yourself a Viscount, as far as we care. But you can call yourself a Viscount Banger, which is, of course, our top rating for our favorite stories. And if you contribute to that level, you might even be here right now with us.
That's
this
right.
Could be us, but you not paying. Cough up and join us on the actual podcast itself. And it'll be fun to talk to you then.
Not only that, you will be a second contestant on, oh, what's that we're doing now? Could it be the Humoji Challenge?
I would say this is normally the least favorite point of my week, but in this week I watched The Curse of Fenric, so...
Whoa, sorry. Let's not reveal your rating. Yeah, a little bit. But yes, you could be joining Chris right now in guessing a Doctor Who title once I describe to him emojis that represent it. And these are all fan submitted, so people will usually leave a review for the podcast in the Apple Podcast app. That is the absolute best place to give us a Humoji challenge. You can go ahead and look at the Pull to Open Codex, which is our listing of all the Doctor Who episodes there are in sequential order. And you can see which ones already have emoji titles. But honestly, even if it already has one, go ahead and submit a new one. We like new interpretations of the show. That's kind of what this podcast is. Mm-hmm. And you can leave us a emoji. That's really all you need to leave in that review, apart from a star rating. And I'm seeing 5 stars in front of me for some reason. I don't know why. But if you could go ahead and do that, then we will happily use it now, as I'm using this emoji to torture Chris into finding the words of the title that go with it. And I honestly think this time, Chris, this is going to be not necessarily a pleasure, but I don't think it's going to be torture for you. I really don't. I know I've made that prediction before and I've been wrong.
That's when I'm on my guard when you say that.
Yeah. So maybe I don't think I'm doing reverse psychology this time, though. So, okay. So here we go. Are you ready, sir?
As I'll ever be.
All right. One emoji.
Okay.
And
it'll be quick.
I feel like I can't say it, but I'm going to. It's a rose.
Well, it's clearly survival. No. The TV movie. No. Rose.
It's Rose. Hey. There we go. I feel like I should say now, fooled you, that wasn't really it. But that was really it.
Yeah.
That was the emoji. We had to get that one out of the way. I mean, that's what I feel like. You just got to do it.
Yeah. You too can find the easy gaps in our list of emojis. Rose. Follow that by the end of the world. I'm sure you can think of some emoji that would make that up. But yes,
I'm just going to say that. This emoji was just this once, comma Rose.
Yeah, it was. And it's kind of nice to know that this is just, what, three stories in the future from Curse of Fenric is Rose. So, thank you for that.
Oh, wow. It didn't even occur to me. That's amazing. Yeah. Well, this one comes from Joe Rep, longtime friend of the pod. Thank you so much, Joe. We got a few more from him. And I'll tell you this, Chris, they do not get easier.
Okay. I think I'm fine with that. I'm ready. I'm ready for more. But thank you, Joe, for an easy one to start with in this not very easy week.
All right, moving on, folks. We don't just talk about Doctor Who episodes. We come back and talk about them again. We don't leave people hanging. We don't leave loose threads, because once we rate a show, we want to hear what you think of it. And we want to compare notes. And this is a little thing we like to call poll to open.
Yeah, so this open. It's all part of the poll to open master plan that will not be hampered by cancellation. But we do have your decision on Death of the Daleks, and it is a decision of cancellation. You've decided to cancel Death of the Daleks in the polls.
Overwhelmingly, I'll say.
Overwhelmingly, yes. I rated this story an Ogron, which is our lowest ratings, irredeemably bad. You gave it a Professor Hater because you thought at least they tried something. And the results are in, and 71.4% of respondents agree with me that this is a full-on, irredeemable, lumbering, hairy old Ogron.
Yeah, it's tragic, but that's okay. I can deal with that. Maybe I was a little too generous for those Daleks with machine guns and the ancient city. And just, Liz Sladen, I think, levels up stuff, even in her first season. So I get it. I was a hater, but the haters are definitely in the minority, or hovering around 15%, just like the Fixed Point in Time crew, which is roughly the same. Interesting choice on Fixed Point in Time. I wonder what the rationale is there.
I think wasn't Death of the Daleks one of the earliest VHSs, or am I thinking of another Pertwee Dalek story? I think this might have been.
I think you might be right.
One of the ones that you could just see early in your Doctor Who fandom, so you could see a lot.
So it could be a little more nostalgia. Yeah, a little nostalgia for it. I get it.
Yeah, nostalgia ratings. But yeah, overwhelming victory for the Ogron. But the poll is still open. You can go back to our Death of the Daleks podcast and vote on that. You can vote right now if you're on Spotify, without even stopping listening to us. Pull from the bottom of the screen. You'll get a poll on the Curse of Fenric. And my goodness, I'm really, really interested, dear listener, in what you're going to rate this one. Because, I kind of feel like I'm taking crazy pills here. So we'll get into that. But let's also get into your opinion. Please vote. Create a Spotify burner account and vote again. Hell, we don't care. We're not about election integrity here at Pull to Open. Vote at the strength of your feelings. That's what I'll say.
Not exactly setting a good democratic precedent for 2024, I'll say, but that's neither here nor there. And you know what? I'm tempted to stall, but let's do it. Let's go, man. We're going into it right now.
We're not going to stall like Stallman. We're going to get into how we start every commentary, which is unlike every other Doctor Who podcast that does a commentary on a story. They will just sort of go through it methodically, scene by scene, line by line, episode by episode. No, we don't do all of that. We summarize the entire story for you at a rate of 30 seconds per classic episode. 1 minute per New Who episode. This is classic. This is the second to last classic story. It is four episodes, and that means that the sucker who's doing this week's TLDW will have a whole 2 minutes. And oh, that's you, Pete. No, I gotta say, I'm not gonna like sincere thank you for to the random god for choosing you on this one, because I was really struggling with even understanding the story. And we'll get to that later. Like, I really want to talk about this notion of like when you get lost in a Doctor Who story, and not in a good way, which I think does happen to us sometimes, even us fans. So for that reason, I'm kind of excited to lean back for the next 2 minutes and listen to Pete explain what the hell it was we just saw in The Curse of Fenric in 2 minutes. How are you feeling about that, sir?
Well, I'm glad one of us is looking forward to it. I'm feeling frickin' terrified, to be honest with you. I mean, the thought of this TLDW scares me way more than anything in the episode did, because, yes, there is a lot in this. And just as like you can have a lot of ingredients in a delicious cake, and you can also have a lot of ingredients in a big pile of gunk that you just stuff in a baking sheet in your oven, you can have a lot in both of those things.
Yeah.
But the result is a little different, perhaps quite a bit different for either.
Right. So, all right. We'll set your oven to 5,000 degrees. Get your pile of gunk ready, and let's see what happens with a baking time of 2 minutes. The official pull-to-open summary of The Curse of Fenric in 2 minutes, starting now.
Okay, so the Doctor and Ace materialize at this Navy base in Northumbria, right in World War II. There's all these Russians that are coming there, but what's happened is that there is this ancient creature beneath the sea that has been sort of contaminating this place, and it's starting to wake up. And there's also a curse that is attached to the place, because it's from Viking lore. And so basically there's this being called Fenric, who is like this pure evil thing that the Doctor has encountered before and has done these sort of games with, and is eventually imprisoned it there, but it's busting out. And it's also manipulated time such that there is an ancient creature that's actually from the future, when the earth is completely covered in slime and dying, and it's there. And he was basically has been manipulating all these people, from the soldiers there and the British commander, who's sort of thinks he's helping with the war, but he's really gone insane, and the sort of Alan Turing type who's developing this machine, and Ace herself, and the local villagers who are sort of turned into these vampires. And he's basically manipulated all of them like chess pieces to force the Doctor to come here and then finally conquer him in the chess game and kill him. But he doesn't count on the Doctor convincing the creature from the future to not destroy its own future by destroying the Earth now. So that thing kills Fenric, and prevents them from contaminating the world with all the chemical weapons that have been sort of created here. And eventually Ace sort of, she also encounters her mom and as a baby, and sort of deals with her own issues there, and conquers fears, even though her faith in the Doctor is shaken, and she just matures and no longer is afraid of water. And all the soldiers teamed up sort of toward at the end to stop everything.
Okay. Yeah. I like that. I mean, first of all, it was in part clearer than the story, because you got to Fenric kind of straight away. I kind of like that.
What I realized, there was zero hope. And this is actually a general lesson of pull to open TLDWs, but also this one very specifically, there would be zero hope of me getting through that even in 10 minutes if I tried to tell the story sequentially. There was just no way. There's so many weird things happen, so many random things happen, so many random characters just pop out and do things like, some stuff seems relevant but isn't, and some stuff you blink and you miss it, and it was the most relevant thing they could have done. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, it was just it's a random jumble of things that, but like, to your point, I see why you never got through or past episode one, because you're just like, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, it really, I mean, you open with, you know, and this is one of those rare TLDWs where we didn't open with what it actually opens with, which is the Russians in boats coming to a beach. But why? And they've got very bad kind of subtitles in front of them. And subtitles since 70s Doctor Who, and the last as of now, I believe. I don't think there are even subtitles anywhere in the new series, right?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure. But it's not first since The Mind of Evil. So and one quick thing about the subtitles, they look horrible. I don't know what they were thinking with that sort of computer font. I mean, I guess I know what they were thinking, that they couldn't really change it. That is obviously, this was done sort of last minute and whatever systems they have were too primitive. So that's obviously what happened. To their credit, they clean that up in the special edition. So you might not know that there is a special edition of this that essentially turns it into an omnibus, which is to say the cliffhangers are all taken out, which I don't think is an entirely great choice. Hmm. But they do sort of update it. The look is better. So I feel like do you mind if I get something off my chest right off the
bat
here?
Please go for it.
Okay. So again, we're going to be slamming this episode a bit. I want to get my main slam out of the way. And it's not just a slam of The Curse of Fenric. It's a slam of this era of Doctor Who. Yes. And I take no pleasure in this. Okay. I really don't. Because I'm a child of the 80s. I like 80s culture. I just saw Back to the Future, the musical. Okay. Like, I love the 80s. I grew up in the 80s. There's amazing good stuff in the 80s. This is not an example of good 80s entertainment. And a big part of the reason is what was going on with Doctor Who at the time, which was the budget was slashed. And for all of the McCoy era, they were running on fumes. But it really looks like here, they're really out of gas. It's not just that it's the budget slashed, and Doctor Who was never like a big budget production, but it really does look like they're filming this in people's backyards and they really are paying people nothing. And it's not like Doctor Who is known for its good effects and good production values, but here it just feels like it's amateur. The cast is capable. Like, don't get me wrong, everyone loves Sophie Aldred, Sylvester McCoy. They're capable, they're ready, they're there to show up for it. But the direction, sloppy. Like, shots and stuff just don't, like, why? You're just constantly, why? The editing is clumsy. The sound, it's echoey. Again, I take no pleasure in saying this, but the show on a technical level, it really just feels like it's being done by people who don't know what they're doing. They're just not good at their jobs. And I'm not going to name any names, and I'm sure they all have good reasons for why. And yes, Doctor Who has never had enough time to make the show that they really want to make. Mm-hmm. But here, that's really no exaggeration to say that The Curse of Fenric and several other episodes in this sort of this orbit of McCoy, they just look like they're fan made. They look like they're fan made videos.
They do. And it's not like, you know, if you're thinking we're going to have a merry old chat about The Curse of Fenric as sort of being laughably nicely bad, you know, so bad it's good. It's not that. It's dreary. And it looks dreary. And it's like, you know, shot on videotape outside with like, there's a point where there's supposed to be apocalyptic rain. And it's like just, you know, they've dribbled in water from a garden hose. This really looks like a show that wants to die. And to your point about the audio, it sounds like a show that doesn't want to be heard. In fact, you know, you may remember, you know, we've been talking about the BritBox boycott that I'm on, where I don't want to pay BritBox money. I think we can kind of retire the BritBox boycott now because it's on Tubi. Most of Classic Who is on Tubi. You have to endure commercials. I got to say, the commercials were actually a welcome break for me when I was watching this. I never said that before. I hate commercials. But the reason that I did that, the reason I went to Tubi and you know, relented and watched Doctor Who with the commercials, something I'd normally never do, is that there is a version on the Internet Archive. You can actually download a version on the Internet Archive, but it doesn't have subtitles. And I could not follow. That's one of the reasons why I watched episode one yet again, was that I tried it without subtitles. I could not make out a single damn word anywhere.
Yeah.
Didn't get it. And the more research I've done on the background of this, it sort of seems like, yes, you know, we all know that Michael Grade was down on Doctor Who. You know, the stuffy upper class custodians of the BBC were down on Doctor Who. They hated it. But it also seems like the production team has kind of internalized that.
Yeah, agreed.
Like they don't seem to know what they're doing. JNT has tried to quit the series several times at this point.
Right. They keep pulling him back in.
They keep pulling him back in, and he keeps making the worst decisions, like changing the order of this so that something that's supposed to be, I think, a preview of Ghostlight, with Ace and the old house that she talks about in her town, Perivale, is completely messed up.
Yeah.
Like, it just, you know, the unveiling of the Doctor's new costume is messed up. You know,
and yeah.
Such a chronicle of haplessness. The fact that JNT sort of tried to organize a press screening of this to say, look, hey, you know, Doctor Who's getting better. And then it ends up being the first, and I believe the only, Doctor Who story in the history of the program to where the audience figures were so low, it actually dropped out of the charts. So we don't even know what the audience ratings were. And mistakes all over the shop. And Andrew Cartmell, the script editor at the time, who was kind of behind a lot of this, and Ian Briggs was the writer, and they worked together very closely. Like, he's written a lot of sort of self-justifying stuff, and there's this myth that's grown up around the Cartmell master plan, and the Doctor was supposed to be getting evil and more Machiavellian. And
right.
First of all, why would you take that direction since we've already done that with Colin Baker? We've already tried an evil Doctor.
Well, no, okay, go on, finish your point, and I'll do the rebuttal.
But like, it just, that sort of seems to be covering up just like a very bad series of decisions in the, like, we're supposed to be excited that Fenric finally, but by the time Fenric gets into it, like, we've had three episodes of this. And we just don't, I don't care anymore. I'm so totally lost that I don't give a damn about this old enemy of the Doctor's, who's someone I don't even know about. And I just...
Right.
Yeah, so
listen, so...
I feel bad that I hate it, but I hate it.
Well, here's the thing. I might surprise you a bit after my sort of rant about the production values, because I it's more like... It's not so much a rant as like I'm rending my garment. I'm so outraged and sad that... It's come to this for the production, but the story I will push back on a little bit. And I will even push back a little bit on the, only a little bit on the Cartmell stuff, because yes, it's true. He didn't really have a master plan to my knowledge. And it was really just more a series of, you know, choices. But I gotta say, I think those choices work, and they have amounted to surprisingly, some McCoy, one of the better defined Doctors as a character, right? Just because he was given so many of these scripts where he is a bit of a master manipulator, and it's apparently the second meeting of some ancient thing he's set in motion, you know, eons ago. And so, and he's sort of playing that role of the player on the other side, the white chess master, where the other person, the black chess master. This is obviously the most literal rendition of that, but you see it again and again in Battlefield, Battlefield I like, because they kind of flip that, because it's his first meeting, and it's the future him that has sort of gotten him into trouble there. So that's funny on that level. But I do think, even though there was no real through line to all this, the idea of like, oh yeah, let's let's have Sylvester be a little more removed, a little more of that manipulator Machiavellian thing. Let's just write the scripts that way. That kind of works. At least it works the first couple of times. I think it works decently here. And again, the show, this is a really ambitious script with all the things in it. So just to sort of start, like, one, I have to give it a points for setting it in World War II, which is rarer than you think in Doctor Who.
Yeah, this is the first time, right?
Is it actually the first time they actually set it in World War II?
Yeah.
It might be.
I believe so, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, but course, you don't really...
We always go to Empty Child Dr. Danzas when we think of Doctor Who in World War II, and of course this precedes that.
Well, and there's actually, like, a couple of novels, not to get too off topic, but... McCoy comes back with, there's a Cyberman adventure. It's called Illegal Alien. That's what it is. And then there's another one called Just War, which is pretty kind of epic. So like there was definitely a lot of sort of coming back around for the McCoy doctor in this, this World War II era. But I do think that the setting works. I think it's a little too, like, again, production values don't really match. It's really sunny. It seems like this is also very connected, like there's a village here, and yes, there's a point where they wreck the radios, but you also think, like, well, surely, like, you could just ride to the next town or something. Like, I mean, what's, like, what's the problem? Like, it just seems like it's not, they were trying to create this sense of isolation, and you, nothing in the direction and the set, you know, just the set and everything emphasizes that. You just feel like anyone could just go to the corner store or go downtown and you'd be fine.
There's so much that is not explained about the setting, and I was not surprised to learn that the setting was a last-minute choice. It was originally supposed to be set in Coventry, which really got hit by the Luftwaffe in World War II. Destroyed. So, and then, no, that there was this attempt to sort of make a reference to Dracula, which is set largely in the town of Whitby.
Makes sense. Vampires and stuff.
Yeah, vampires and stuff, which, of course, they weren't allowed to use vampires. So they invent the word hemivores, because J&T thought, oh, no, everyone's going to be, like, thinking of State of Decay.
yes.
Are they? Really?
Are they, though?
Are they, though? Like, you know, and you just call them hemivores, which means blood eaters. Okay. So now you're just confusing people who are like, wait a minute, are they vampires or what?
But it's also like it's not like the word vampires is not in the script. They actually say the word several times. So I guess they kind of, it's the Doctor Who version of that word, which is kind of okay. I kind of get what J&T's saying. I definitely don't think anyone would care what happened in 1980, whenever State of Decay was, which was would have been... Eight or nine years previous to this.
It was 9 years previously. Like, okay, you know, and of course we're talking about Creatures from the Dawn of Time, so why not continue that whole thing that the vampires and the Time Lords were ancient enemies from the Dawn of Time? Like, that would have made this make a lot more sense and at least provided some continuity. And you definitely get the sense with J&T here that he's sort of fiddling while Rome burns. Like, he's handing down these tiny diktats that just are ignoring and obscuring this vast overall problem of just how terrible everything looks, and, you know, the poor directorial choices and all of it. And
yeah.
The poor choices. But I want to say, like, you know, while we're on the location, so regular Pull to Open listeners now, I'm from the northeast of England, and we've done two stories previously that were set in the northeast of England, one being the Rani... The thing, not Time and the Rani. Why am I not remembering the original Rani?
Oh, a Mark of the Rani.
Mark of the Rani, not Curse of the Rani. Mark of the Rani, which weirdly does not contain a character named Mark. But anyway, it's So that's one northeast story. You know, features George Stevenson, has a reason to be set in the northeast. Then we had the Time Meddler. And I actually went to the Abbey that we discovered with the help of our friends.
Right.
The Cloisterbell podcast, a northeastern-based podcast, was the only abbey that it could possibly be in the Time Meddler, you know, which makes sense because that's where the Vikings invaded in 1066. Like, this, you know, there's a historical reason for it to be here. What the hell is the reason for setting Curse of Fenric in the northeast? There is none. It's just that it's not Coventry. It's sort of a flicking at the setting of Whitby in Dracula, but not really. You've got, I think, one or two people with vaguely local accents, except they're Yorkshire, you know, like the nurse. So there's just no reason for it, you know, and you invent Maiden's Point. You don't even film it up there. They filmed it on the south coast of England, which is another, you know, poke in the eye for people in the northeast who almost never get the BBC to come up and, you know, do location shoots in their area. So yeah, I'm sort of got my face set against this for a number of reasons, and that's
I feel like they're inconsistent even within their story, because it's like, if it's the northeast of England, do people really do a lot of swimming there? And but even if they do, like, you have, like, it looks just really cold, and some of the characters even remark how cold it is. And even if the doctor in that coat early on, and then suddenly people are going swimming like it's, you know, mid-July. And you're like, well, wait a second. Is it mid-July? Because it feels like it's more like Halloween. And would it be really, would people be really diving into the ocean in Northumbria at that time of year?
I mean, yes, but you would know what to expect. And Ace, you know, so Ace has the scene with, did we even mention the evacuees?
Phyllis and Jean, I think they are.
Yeah.
The two girls.
Not really the best drawn characters. Their whole reason, the original script, speaking of things that J&T cut, is to sort of say that they're not maidens. Like, you know, And then Ace says, me neither. And the idea of this, did you know this from Ian Briggs' original script? Because, you know, we don't have to give him credit for creating the character Ace. The original character was supposed to be called Alf, and he basically made it Ace. He was looking for something based on the Love and Rockets comic. He wanted, like, a London version of the sort of, you know, DMs and, you know, a powerful female character. So credit him for that. But it was his idea that Ace's virginity had been taken by Sabalon Glitz.
Right. I read something about this. Yeah. Which is okay.
Gross. No, I just recoil at that.
Well, especially because, like, she was a teenager.
Yes, exactly.
Right. She's like 16 in Dragonfire, I think. Which
it's
is
not right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, luckily that isn't necessarily on screen. Now, all that said, we shouldn't be full on prudes here and say, like, okay, like, Ace being not a virgin is somehow over the line. I mean, you know, she's a teenager. Teenagers can be sexually active. I'm not saying, you know, trying to make a moral judgment either way on that, but it's a reality. And I think it's okay to have that sort of be part of her, you know, quote unquote journey here. Like, particularly, I didn't mind the bit in, I forget if it's episode 3 or 4, where she tells the doctor, I'm not a little girl, and she's going to woo the guy, essentially. And she ostensibly does. What I don't like, again, and there's a bunch of this, and you alluded to this, I think, a bit with the maidens or the evacuees. Everyone's weird. Why is everyone acting so weird? In, you know, I walked just with Grace, and that scene in particular where she kind of woos the guard away by being not sexy, I will say. Like, she's just really, really strange. And she turned to me, Grace is like, okay, like, being strange is going to lure him away? Like, what is that about? Like, because she got it, you know, even though she's 10, she understands, okay, like, she's trying to tantalize him.
Yeah, but we all know what a seduction looks like, and that's not it. And I got to say, look, I love Sophie Aldred as a person. But I got to take issue with the notion that she is actually a good actor at this stage. I'm sorry, I don't buy it throughout. And maybe this has always been my problem with Ace. Like, she never really felt real to me. I'm sorry, Ace fans. I'm sorry. I think she's a wonderful idea. I love her beating Daleks to death with a baseball bat. You know, I kind of like the professor thing, even though it gets a bit annoying, but, you know, it's Doctor trying something new. Like, you know, Ace is a bit of a professor hater of a character for me, you know, at least.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I have similar thoughts about Tegan too. Like, Janet Fielding seemed pretty new at it, at least early on. I kind of get it though, particularly for these younger characters who, like, I'm not sort of saying you're wrong. I'm just saying, I think it works a little better because younger people are naturally a little more histrionic and awkward and say things either in the wrong way or at the wrong times. Now, here, I think it's, you know, certainly partly the director, and the director not helping her be new at this. So I actually had to rewind a couple of bits because I didn't understand the meaning of what she was saying. Like, I understood the words, but what was she trying to get across? One of them was when the doctor talks about, they're walking and Ace is behind them, and he says, like, oh, no one tell Judson the logic, solve the logic problem or whatever. And Grace is like, oh, you should have told me. But it doesn't come across that way. Like, that's the timing of it is strange. You're not sure what Ace means by that. And I was like, oh, and then we watched it again and we're like, oh, I get it. She's concerned about him getting this information that he shouldn't get. But it should be more obvious than that, right? Like, I mean, it's like there are ways to shoot things so that you can get that point across, and they just didn't do it. And that happens time and time again. Another example, because we were talking about wooing people, the point where the girls who are now turned into vampires / hemivores are in the water and they're luring that Russian soldier, and they're doing that thing with the claws, like
the claws. And which a friend of mine who loves horror movies recognizes the thing that they do in Plan 9 from Outer Space, which is really not a movie you want to emulate.
Sorry, it's taken. It's one of those sort of B movie things where the fingers are doing the acting.
It renowned as the worst movie of all time. You know, there's that movie Ed Wood that's basically about the filming of it.
Oh wow. Well, anyway, when they're luring the guy, not only are they weird and they have this really unnecessary dialogue where they're like, come in the water, or whatever. And it's like, we get it. We know what you're doing. You actually don't need them any dialogue there. Mm-hmm. And he kind of like, he literally goes in the water like a zombie. Like the way he's moving, like it's very clumsy. And you almost think he's exaggerating his movements because is he trying to get across that he's being literally controlled? And if he's being controlled, why do you need to tempt him at all? But if he's not being controlled, like, he's not behaving like a guy who is being tempted, right? He's not like playing it that way. Is it? It's like some extra that they just said, act this way. And he clumsily just sort of goes in the water like he's a doofus.
Yeah.
And then they can jump on him. It's just like, what are you doing here? What are you making? Again, I think I'm sort of circling back to my original point of the production values here, but it really affects the story in places, and it really didn't have to. And you're just wincing. You're just like, oh, really? Did you?
Yeah,
I know what you're doing here. I wish you'd hired me to like do something, even though I know nothing about television production. I could have helped you.
And to be fair, you know, Ian Briggs did clear a lot of things up with the novelization. You know, which is definitely better. I don't think it's brilliant, but it's better. And one of the things that does clear up, so yes, The Curse of Fenric is sort of Doctor Who's first faltering attempt to deal with sexuality in a lot of ways. And one of those things is one of those attempts to deal with sexuality has to do with Dr. Judson, who is based on Alan Turing. And in other circumstances, I might want to do a whole history corner on Alan Turing. But I think it's a mark of The Curse of Fenric that I've absolutely no desire to do that. But that is so, that is the undercurrent, and maybe why Dr. Judson's so mad all the time, is that he and Commander Millington actually had an affair in school. There was this whole thing with a rugby match, and one of them got jealous that the other one was looking at another boy. And, you know, that's why Judson ended up getting, becoming disabled. So, but it's like, we look back at that now, that does not age well. I see what they were trying to do, but this is a trope that, you know, the idea that a character is gay or closeted in some way, and therefore you give him another affliction. In this case,
right.
You know, it being in a wheelchair like that, we look at that today and wince like, oh, he was supposed to be gay. So you stick him in a wheelchair and that's supposed to, you know, give us a hint that he's closeted in some way. Like, just no. What are you even doing?
That is the attempt. Yeah. And it's if any, nothing really survives of that. Plot line, right? Like, so it's really just a couple of guys and they're just acting weird and angry, and again, nothing's really made of it. So yeah, to your point, if this is Doctor Who's attempt at sexuality, like, I'll take the Aztecs over it any day, you know, and the Doctor and Kamika's non-relationship over it every day of the week, twice on Sunday. But you brought up Millington, and I got to say, like, I do think the book improves his character because they basically say he's insane from the get-go in the book.
Yeah.
And here you kind of have to figure it out. But I also feel like he's very forgettable of all the people in this. Like, even Judson, even before he becomes Fenric, is kind of like, you know, you're kind of interested in what he's doing and how he's trying to sort of advance this. I'm a little interested in the Russian folks. But, like, the guy who's ostensibly in charge of the base and wants to use these chemical weapons, like, you know, the Brigadier, he ain't. You know what I mean? Like, he's not really in it much. And
he should be, given that he's got a whole office full of Nazi memorabilia. And he's set, which, again, just like, why? Like, I feel like, you know, this is familiar to us from the problem with the Magician's Apprentice. Too many ideas stuffed in. Well,
yeah.
The Curse of Fenric definitely shows that the old series could do that as well. And this is one of them. Like, he's clearly kind of a bit of a Nazi sympathizer. Like, you know, his interest in the Nazis is more than just academic. Because he's, like, really anti-communist, really anti-Soviet.
Well, I don't know if he's a sympathizer as much as he's just kind of nuts and obsessive. And I kind of like that idea in a less complicated episode. Because I did like that the Doctor goes, he's not a Nazi. He's just trying to get inside the minds of them and doing it in this really literal way.
And how does that help exactly?
Well, exactly. Like,
headquarters help?
I think it's one too many ideas stacked in, and the fact that they throw it in episode one and it's so dramatic, I mean, it just really confuses you. Like, there should have been more in early on to reassure viewers that it's all going to sort of come, it's all going to make sense by the end, which it doesn't. I'll say that it all doesn't make sense by the end, but lots of it does. I think I need to sort of start praising the episode a bit, because I do think it does come around in episode four. Like, episode four is by far the best of all of it.
And
I will say the cliffhanger in episode three is very good, with Judson standing up, the yellow eyes, and he says, "At last, we play the final game, Time Lord," or some line like that. And when he says Time Lord, you kind of like, oh wow, like these are bigger stakes than I even thought. And
I said out loud at that point, "At last, something is happening."
And so then episode four, there's a lot of sort of fighting again, the action, we can talk about the action, but you know, the Ancient One is there now, and there's a very clear kind of like, okay, everything's coming together and people sort of get to do stuff. And particularly McCoy, he finally gets to do his thing with the Ancient One, and sort of entirely just explain stuff like where things are from, how this was all set in motion. And I think for the most part, it makes some sense. Right. And that's kind of all my TLDW was explaining what happened here. Oh, okay. I get it. This thing from Earth's future. And that I liked because it had a bit of a Talons of Wang Chiang feel to it. Like this, this dystopian future that something's come back from and is now going to wreak havoc on the present. That's kind of neat. You know, it's like, okay, I like that. And the fact that it also simultaneously ties up loose ends seemingly from other episodes that we weren't necessarily looking for explanations of, but it's more satisfying to go like, oh, right. Dragonfire was, you know, that was Fenric, and all this casual time travel they were doing in the McCoy era. Oh, it was Fenric manipulating things. Great. It's not that you could actually create just a time vortex in your bedroom by mixing stuff together for your chemistry class or whatever Ace did. Right. So
Fenric made a jigsaw of the Doctor's history to quote.
Yeah. There you go.
But it's not even really said. Like, we're just half supposed to piece that together, and it just, like, how are you supposed to remember it? Like, if that episode three cliffhanger, I did like it. I would have liked it a lot more if there'd been more misdirect to think that Millington was going to be Fenric, or that anyone was going to be, like, we should have been expecting the big bad to rise up in that moment. And I wasn't, at least. Like, you know, but at least there was that little bit of, like, I think Ace says it's him. about Millington. Like, oh yeah, Millington's the big bad guy. I get that. That explains it. That's why he's got the Nazi regalia and stuff like that. Oh, this makes sense. And then, oh no, misdirect. It's actually Judson. He rises up over the doctor's shoulder. One of the few actually good shots that the director got.
Yeah.
And then, yes, the eye is creepy. And I did like Dr. Judson Disdale Landon as the actor.
Speaking of, like, it's one of the only effects that works is those eyes.
Yeah.
Speaking of, you know, just slamming the effects. That actually, you know, good job on the contact lenses or whatever they did.
Genuinely creepy. But then we sort of take the sting out of that in episode 4 by, like, Fenric changes bodies. And then he's Captain Soren now?
Well, and then one of the things we haven't mentioned about the behind the scenes here is this thing was hacked to pieces in the edit, because when they came out with it, they said we really have 5 episodes. Like, this is a 5 episode adventure. And again, J&T, wisely or not, forced them to slash it down to 4, and they did. But that is one of the things that I think a few transitions like that, but that in particular, where it, basically Fenric goes from Judson to Soren, is never really shown, or you really have to sort of piece it together yourself. Now it's kind of obvious once they flip, but you're kind of like, oh, he can do that, you know? Yeah. So it's too much information happens at once because of that.
Yes, exactly. And at the same time, your brain is also trying to deal with this chess puzzle that's not a chess puzzle.
Oh yes. Okay. Let's talk about that. Yes. The chess thing.
The solution to the chess puzzle, spoiler alert, although I can't think why what this would spoil for anyone, is that the black and white pawns are supposed to team up.
And I'll tell you what that spoils, Chris. It spoils chess.
It spoils chess.
That's not how the game is played.
That's how bad Curse of Fenric is. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. I bet they thought they were super clever with this. And it's so clever, it's bad. Yeah. it makes no sense. It's nonsense. Like, one, okay, if you're literally talking about chess, it's obviously an illegal move, because, you know, I can't believe I've been saying this. Like, the friendly fire is not allowed. You simply cannot take your own pieces. So how does that even work? There's no third player. Like, it's not a legal chess move. So if they're literally playing chess, that doesn't work. If they're not, and obviously they're not, and this is some metaphor for something, and there's another game to play that is above the chess, fair enough, but then you're not playing chess. And yeah. I would say the only
it with something in the script about, you know, the white and black teaming up, like is it supposed to reference something about the British and Russian soldiers?
Like, oh yeah, well that's obviously sort of the metaphor there, that they team up. And again, like, I don't, interesting idea. And I kind of like the idea of that happening. But the very few of these guys have been fleshed out. Certainly no one on the British side we've really seen. And then with the Russian guys, they all kind of seem like the same guy to me, to be honest with you. You know,
That's why Soren has his white scarf, not just so he can give it with Ace in a very unbelievable sudden romance. Perhaps the most unbelievable sudden romance since Leela and Andred.
And it's really kind of a blink and you miss it. You know, like, I didn't really even get it, you know, until I sort of read about it in the book. And I'm like, okay. Maybe now some of that makes a little more sense. But I mean, again, I think everyone's just acting weird and no one's being that romantic at all. Like, it's very weird. But anyway, back to the chess move. So I want to sort of contrast this where an episode where I think it works, which is Nightmare in Silver. Now, we'll get there when we get there. But one thing I think that does work there is that the Doctor is playing against himself and he's losing the chess game. And he keeps telling, like, his cyber self, like, I'm going to win in 3 moves. And he's like, no, you've just lost your queen. There's absolutely no way. I've checked. And he's like, well, the three moves are, I'm going to use my sonic screwdriver and zap you and throw the chessboard away or something. Like, I forget what the exact 3 moves are, but it's like, oh, right. You're not just playing chess. You're playing against a cybernetic version of yourself. And that's the real game, you know, like, and that was okay. Here, it's like, there's the connection of the metagame to the real game is much less clear, you know, like, why are they even playing chess? You know, like, they have to get chess sets and he sets up the board again. And Like, what is this proving? Like, why does Fendrick have to stop and play chess? I don't get it.
Yeah. It's supposed to be some, you know, a resumption of a game that we never saw, right? Which you might want to flag that earlier on, or maybe the Doctor could talk about it.
Yeah, and say something like that, like, I bet him that I could beat him at chess, and then, you know, the winner would do X or Y, which is fine to say, but it's also like, well, how is that, like, enforceable? Like, yeah. what's like, if, why wouldn't, why is he acquiescing to this game? And if he doesn't want to lose, why is it binding? Like, what's binding it? You know?
Yeah. So many questions. And why does, is it Millington who wants all the chessboards confiscated? I was losing the plot at this point.
Which is, yes, that's right. He wants them destroyed, not just confiscated. I think he said destroyed. I could be wrong, but It's a bit like he must be somehow in, I forget why he does that too, because either he's getting orders from Fenric or he's interpreting one of the many inscriptions or ancient texts or ancient artifacts that's telling him to do that. Again, just too much stuff happening. Again, I could be wrong. Maybe this is explained somewhere. Please, fans, let us know. But it doesn't take away from the criticism of, like, this is just like so much incomprehensible BS happening at any moment in this adventure that it's like, okay, I guess.
I want to say to the McCoy fans out there who are feeling hard done by in this podcast so far, please come on the show and explain that, you know, give us a Viscount Banger of a follow and, you know, our Viscount Bank level of subscription, and we'll have you on the show, and we'll do a whole special on you explaining the Curse of Fenric to us, because I really want to know. Like, I'm really open to seeing this as good. I want to see this as good. I do not, like, it's a bad feeling in the pit of my stomach that I see this as bad. Like, you know, it's all connected to my rage critic and McCoy, and McCoy feeling like an alien era to me, and, you know, it being two stories away from the cancellation of the show. Like, it just, you know, I want to feel better about it. So please write in, come on the show, whatever. Like, please, you know, we're not fixed in this, right?
Well, why don't we, just to be nice to those people we were just talking to, let's rapid fire the things we liked.
Yeah.
Okay. There might be a short list. So I'll go first. I liked when Phyllis and Jean die. And I don't mean, I mean that on a few levels, but I do like, it's a mature death. Like, too often I would say, and I criticized Knock Knock for this, that was quite a bit ago, but like, there's several episodes where they want to do Everybody Lives or sort of a variation of that, and it just sort of mutes the story. And I like that they, with a lot of the supporting cast, and they just kill them. You know, it's like people die in Doctor Who, and if you have high stakes, you have to show that. And it's a very gruesome death. They sort of, and when they kill all the other hemivores, which to me kind of, it seems like a big tactical blunder, but whatever, they just fall and they sort of disintegrate. And that, again, there aren't that many good special effects in this one, but that one was okay. So mature moment and well rendered.
Yeah. The ancient one, is it? The one with the mask that they clearly spent most of the mask budget on?
Yes. You like the mask?
Kind of like the mask. It's okay. It looks like something from New Who, so I'm going to say that's a positive.
I will say, I wish that guy could have moved. Like, none of the hemivores, they all look like they're really trying not to have their masks fall off. Mm-hmm. So they're just super slow moving. All they're doing is the hand thing. And no one seems to have the ability to just run away from these very slow moving creatures. But yes, Hemivore Mask, the ancient one, 10 out of 10. Okay.
I also like the idea of Faith creating a psychic barrier. Faith in some.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
It's made clear that it's not just faith in a religion. Or maybe it is faith in a religion if you include communism as a religion. That's basically how one of the Russian dudes survives.
Right. Yeah. And it shows the hammer and sickle, which is kind of neat. So yes, I did like that. I also liked that it shows the monsters can be smart by shaking someone's faith. And they do that to Wainwright, the Reverend, because he doesn't have it. They know he doesn't, but he sort of steals himself, finds something within himself, and is able to repel them, but only for like a minute. And then they talk to him, and they get him to shake his, lose his faith again, and then they kill him. That was good. That, like, not only can does this psychic field idea work, but it also provided an opportunity that the villains aren't total boobs. You know, you can actually figure out ways around it. Smart.
So speaking of Wainwright, did you? And we'll get back to the list of what we liked. But did you like Wainwright?
No. He seemed pretty extraneous, and again, there's all this weird incomprehensible stuff with virtually every character, but when he's giving kind of a sermon or something to himself, it looks like,
yeah,
at one point, and
also they use it as a cliffhanger, like it's 1 Corinthians, it's, you know, now there are abideth faith, hope, and love, these three, but the greatest of these is cut away, and I'm like, what the greatest of these is what, like, why would you I wish you pause at that point. Anyway, maybe you would have liked Wainwright better if he'd been played by a certain Peter Capaldi or a certain Christopher Eccleston, both of whom were considered for the role.
Wow. I might have liked it better. That would be amazing. Wow, what a connection. And I got to say, yeah, the guy they cast just seems like the least creepy guy, but I don't think that works for this production.
It doesn't. And his name is Nicholas Parsons. And he was known in the UK as a quiz show host. He was cast by the director, speaking of terrible directorial decisions, after seeing him in pantomime, you know, playing one of the Widow Twanky or something in pantomime, very British thing. But he's like, he sees that, he's like, yep, there's my reverend. But everyone just knew Nicholas Parsons as like this middling quiz show host. His name was like the butt of jokes for a lot of comedians in the 80s, British comedians, new wave British comedians. So if Doctor Who is trying to convince you that it's like young and hip and happening and with it and exploring sexuality for the first time, then choosing Nicholas Parsons for this role is not what you would do. And I think that turned off a lot of viewers. Maybe why it was so lowly rated by the audiences.
Wow, yeah. Well, I just thought he felt like somebody, you know, you would just have a coffee with and be chummy, and he just had the wrong vibe for this story. Was not sorry to see him go when they finally, the Hemivores finally like take him down. But okay, back to the list.
At least he had a crisis of faith, which was nice.
Yeah. Yeah. He got, his character got a chance to have that moment. So I like the overall Ace story here, even though it's not, the moments are weird, especially the stuff with her mom and her kind of hating the baby, which I don't feel, or the loving the baby, but hating her mom, which feels like a weird thing to focus on to me. But I think, again, episode 4 redeems a lot of this with her faith in the doctor and him needing to shake that faith to win. It's funny. It's mirrored a lot in the God Complex, which I never thought about when I had watched this episode before. So, but it is, it's a sort of a smart idea of playing on how companions regard the doctor and whether that's good or bad, particularly from the sort of the faith standpoint. That all worked to me. And then when she at the end, you know, dives in the water, and I get it, the sort of the metaphor of the cleansing and struggling with her sort of feelings with her mom, I think that generally works. I think you could pick at the brush strokes here, but I like the picture.
Yeah, that picture where she dives into the water at the end, and we sort of really want to feel that kind of cleansing, you know, yeah, that would be a good scene if the director had included a single damn close-up. Like that's where the focus should be, right? In her face, she's going through a lot of tortured feelings about,
you know, I'm sorry, Nick Mallet. You know, even the stuff we like, we're bringing back around to you and sort of smacking you in the face on each of it. So is he
sorry about that? I will say I liked the timey-wimey aspect, even if it was so clear that the non-Doctor Who watching friend I watched this with was like, oh, is Audrey, you know, is that baby actually Ace's mother? Like, you know, when the baby gets introduced. And my initial react, because I didn't know at this stage, my initial reaction was, no, that would be too interesting. that would actually bring some sort of interesting timey-wiminess to this. So I will admit I was wrong. It was that, even if it's so clearly telegraphed from a mile off that it's her, that I thought, like, that no, they're not going to do that if it's that clearly telegraphed.
Do you like that line where she asks about her boyfriend and then it's like, no, it's my husband?
Yeah. Remember
that? Did you like weird. That? It wasn't that weird. I could pick at the scene, but I like what they're sort of trying to do and sort of contrast the morality of the 40s with modern day. I think it's like, not, doesn't work as well or is as clear cut as what they do in Remembrance of the Daleks. But here, yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's a little extraneous, but it's all I see it as is sort of a reminder of Ace being out of time and not really having a native time of her own. But anyway, it might have been a little extraneous, I don't know, but I didn't mind it.
Yeah, I mean, you could see it as a first draft of the whole sort of River Song, Born in the TARDIS, kind of, you know, the timey-wiminess, like, you know, Doctor Who's explored this since much better. But I like the idea in theory that it is actually her mother and that she sets it in motion herself by telling the unmarried mother to get to her nan's address, I guess.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Which I guess happened all along.
Yeah. So that does make sense in terms of why they were brought there. Even though I had the question right from the beginning of why were they walking into this naval base? Like, they seem to know that it's a naval base from the start. They don't just blunder in there.
To think of is that, again, there's not enough here. Maybe there was more in the 5-episode version, but the Doctor deliberately took them there to have this final chess move with Fenric. I think that's what the idea was. I don't know if he fully appreciated what was happening, but I think it was also like, The other part of the timey-wimey-ness I like is that the Ancient One has been there for a long time, and that's why there's been various folks disappearing, and it's just kind of a cursed place. And now,
millions of years, Doctor.
Yeah, it's one of those. But again, I yes, but I thought it was okay.
Okay, one more thing I like. Although I didn't realize that it was happening at the time, that the Doctor chants the names of his old companions.
Yeah.
To create a psychic barrier against the Hemovores. Now, it isn't clear what's happening at the time or why he has suddenly realized that this is what he needs to do. But it's sort of nice in retrospect that he's doing that. And he gives a shout out to Ian, Barbara, and Susan. Even though that makes it confusing when he says he has no family and he's literally mentioning Susan in the same frickin' story.
Well, no surviving family. I guess. I don't know. The Doctor lies, my man.
I guess so. But he's just seen Susan alive in the Five Doctors not that long ago.
To talk about there. But also, I mean, we need to talk about things in even more detail in our newsletter, ladies and gentlemen. That you could subscribe to. Yes, if you didn't get enough of our rants on The Curse of Fenric, go to pulltoopen.net, subscribe to our newsletter. You'll get full notes on this episode, and you can relive it all those full written notes. You can also support us with a paid subscription over there, and as well as on Patreon. So go ahead and support the podcast at patreon.com/pulltoopen, and you will also get slotted into that True Companion slot on YouTube. Just let us know your handle.
Yes, and come join us. Come talk about The Curse of Fenric or not. If you decided after listening to us you never want to talk about The Curse of Fenric, that's also fine. Come on, we'll have you talk about anything.
Yeah, in fact, share your desire to never talk about it with us on the socials. We're at Pull to Open on TikTok, Pull to Open 63 on Twitter, and at either one of those on Instagram, Facebook, Threads, and Blue Sky. Just Google it.
Google it.
All right, is it time now?
I think it's time.
It's time for the four questions to Doomsday. All right. Fenric sound effect there. All right, why did the randomizer take us here, really? Come on, dude,
really,
tell me.
Come on, why? Okay, I think that the randomizer is an evil and capricious old god that we've evidently been playing some ancient chess match with that we didn't understand the rules of, and now it's played this move against us. Now, I think that the randomizer actually seems to want to put the Curse of Fenric in the worst possible light. because I think that, you know, a lot of what people like about the Curse of Fenric is that they're watching McCoy in order, right?
Right.
Often with the randomizer, taking a story out of order improves it. I don't think that is the case here. I think it has the exact opposite effect, because especially coming straight from New Who, and New Who with production values like Magician's Apprentice and Witch's Familiar, you really see just how terrible everything was and how bad a decision to shoot everything on location on video with the muddy sound was. You don't get any of the lead, any of the sort of the satisfying answers to the questions that Curse of Fenric provides in terms of, you know, Fenric creating the time vortex or whatever, you know, everything else that he's there to explain previously in the series, or the reference to Peri Vale that, you know, postdates Ghostlight when it should have predated it, but whatever, you know, at least you have that those connecting strands, right? And here it's, you just don't get any of it because we're seeing it out of order. Maybe we are seeing it true, you know, in a way that
yeah, that makes sense. See, I had a simpler explanation. It's that in our codex, the Magician's Apprentice and the Witch's Familiar is story number 257. Mm-hmm. And the Curse of Fenric's yeah, an X. Curse of Fenric is story 157.
Wow.
So I think the randomizer is just lazy.
Yeah. you've read the Viking runes on this, and what you are translating is a story about a randomizer that just wants to go 100 numbers back.
Exactly. We just did the 60th anniversary, so, you know, round numbers are the thing. It's like, boom, nice and simple. So
yeah, and I guess it's this is a 4-year, and that was done in a 9-year, so this is the something 5th anniversary of, is it what, 35th anniversary this year of Curse of Fenric? This
Halloween. Was it?
Yeah,
oh, wow.
Yeah, 1989. It was Halloween 1989 when this was filmed, which is why it's out of order from Ghostlight. It was supposed to precede it, but then J&T is all like, no, Curse of Fenric for Halloween.
So this is like the 35th anniversary of this story this year?
It will be, yeah.
Wow. This is like the Three Doctors of the Curse of Fenric. Okay.
Yeah.
Too many references. Moving on. Second question. What if the evil plot had succeeded?
Okay, so presumably the evil plot is Fenric's and not Doctor's Evil, the Doctor's Evil plot to make Ace hate him. You know, if that succeeds, maybe it happens permanently and Ace doesn't adventure on with him.
Yeah, I don't think the Doctor is such a manipulator at this stage that to smack him around for that, you'd have to smack him around for it in every episode. But we could do that. But I think it's pretty simple in that the thing that would not work is the Doctor convincing the Ancient One to betray Fenric. Because he has to do that. He has to have a conversation with him and say that you can't win because you will prevent yourself from coming into existence if you do this. That seems to convince him.
Right.
So if he's not persuaded,
I'm going to actually sacrifice myself to give Earth a better future because the future I'm seeing is worse than anything you can imagine.
Yeah. I guess. But doesn't it want it worse? It's a weird thing. You don't really get too much into the Ancient One's character. He just seems really bored, to be honest with you.
Yes.
Like, what do you need me to do here, Fenric? Huh? You want me to smash this guy open? Should I throw the chemicals on the girl here? What are we doing? Let me know. I just want to get back to my, you know, seabed and hang out.
Yeah. Speaking of the chemicals, like that, the notion that they're going to have any effect whatsoever is kind of counteracted by the fact that the Doctor and Ace kind of get gassed. by the
Well, I don't know if that was the same stuff, but to your point, yeah, because the effect in that scene seems to show that they're really gassed. Like, yeah. There's a lot of gas, and then they're fine. But the gas, like, it's supposed to be like nerve gas, right? Mm-hmm. And that's bad.
Yeah, it's bad. You need gas masks for that if you're even going to have a hope of surviving it. So what? Is the TARDIS protecting the Doctor and Ace somehow?
I guess.
Even though, by the way, apparently the TARDIS has given up on translating.
Oh, yeah. The Doctor does a lot of Russian and various other languages, and maybe even Viking or something.
Yeah. And you'd think that the TARDIS would do that. But anyway, sorry. Get back to the evil plot.
Yeah.
Succeeding.
Well, I just think the Ancient One then doesn't work for the Doctor, sides with Fenric, it kills Ace, and presumably the Doctor. So we have McGann all of a sudden, and the chemicals... I don't know how sudden the end of the world happens. Like, it feels like they have to distribute these chemicals somehow. So the McGann Doctor then has to save whatever humans he can from the chemical weapons and the Hemivore. Or is it Hemivore? I guess the Hemivores are dead, right? Because the Ancient One kills them. Which, again, I don't even know why he does that. It seems like a real tactical blunder. Now my soldiers are gone, and I haven't actually won yet.
So the end of the world that's being referenced here, I believe, is supposed to be Ragnarok.
Okay. Right? Yeah. That was actually excised from the script, the word.
It was excised from the script because, again, JNT is like, no, we had mention of the gods of Ragnarok like a season ago.
Yeah.
You know, people are going to be like, what's this?
That I'll buy a little bit, but Ragnarok's Ragnarok, dude.
Exactly. I would have bought Ragnarok. So, you know, that would be, I guess, the answer to what happened to the evil plot succeed. You know, ancient Norse Ragnarok, which is a very specific thing about the world folding up but not being disposed of entirely and the whole cycle starting again.
So there's Ragnarok, and we have a McGann Doctor that's doing what he can to fight Ancient One and Fenric on a ravaged Earth.
Okay, that I'm interested in. Now you have my attention. Now you have a continued Doctor Who series that doesn't actually enter cancellation. Paul McGann versus the forces of Ragnarok. I'm in. I'm sitting down in front of that. Get Neil Gaiman to write for it. He's a up and coming comic book writer at the time, but he's really into Norse mythology.
I think this is a big Finnish call us.
Yes. Redeeming the curse of Fenric with Ragnarok and Paul McGann. I love it. We'll totally do that. We'll write that for you, Big Finish.
All right. We're coming up on the next question, which is, where is the Clara Splinter? All right. So here's where I've got her.
Clara there Rosa, are... by the way, was splintered in time at the end of the name of the Doctor. She's somewhere in the background of every Doctor Who story. We know that she saves the McCoy Doctor from his literal cliffhanger with the umbrella, or at least shouts at him. Where is she in the Curse of Fenric, Pete?
I think she's running the local hobby shop. So someone has to be supplying people with all these chess sets. And she is ensuring there is a healthy variety of them. They're all over the place. And she's specifically sourcing them from Nordic countries, too. So you got some Viking ones in there in the mix. Mm. So that's what she's doing, making sure there's a healthy supply of chess playing and chess sets all over the place here.
Yeah, chess. Clara the chess salesperson. Yeah, I like that. Yeah,
there's
not a lot of other things to do in the Northeast. Here's my issue that I'm hoping you can help me figure out how Clara can clear this up. Because so much of this is dependent on bloodlines, right? On the idea that everyone's a relative of the Vikings who settled this. If you're a relative of the Vikings who settled this area, then you are a wolf of Fenric.
Right. Okay, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So the problem is, something we now know through genetics, which they did not know at the time, is that if you go as far back as 1000 AD, literally everyone in Europe is a descendant of everyone in Europe at that time.
Okay.
It is, you know, I highly recommend it. You look up the work of the geneticist Adam Rutherford, who writes a lot of books about this. He's written a lot of stories about this. But he mentions, like, you know, he trades off the fact that, you know, Christopher Lee, the actor, used to say that he was descended from Charlemagne.
Right, yeah.
You know, that he traces his family tree to Charlemagne. Well, guess what? Literally everyone in Europe is descended from Charlemagne. Because there just aren't enough great-great-great-great-great-great grandparents to go around, and eventually they double up. And they double up faster if you're a European royal and you're inbred, but they double up for everyone eventually. So by the in fact, the date that they have set is 1000, right around where the Vikings appear. Everyone has a common ancestor. So everyone is descended. So everyone's a Wolf of Fenric. So either Clara is like distributing, you know, pills to some of the people in the base to stop them being affected by this bloodline thing, or she's creating a different, like, she's put them into like a different genetic universe where that doesn't work, where there is a very specific bloodline. I don't know. Help me out here, Pete.
You're way beyond help. I was out of zoning out when you were saying everyone in Europe, the relative of everyone in Europe, which is like, it's kind of like one equals one.
But everyone in Europe now is a relative of everyone in Europe then in the year 1000. If you go any further forward, like 1100.
But I mean, I guess, is your point that she's somehow responsible for certain people not being affected by Fenric, even though everyone is technically could be a wolf of Fenric, right? Yes. So yeah. I guess there's that. Maybe so
she's running around as she's selling chess sets.
And dream catchers or something. Or just books on faith. That's what she's selling. Self-help. That's what's helping everyone resist. Okay. I like that. She's figuring it out. All right, it's time for the final question, the ultimate question, the only question that matters for the curse of Fenric. What did we think of this story? The Bolt Open rating system has 6 ratings. There's the Dalek, which we give to a good episode of Doctor Who. The Ogron, which we give to an irredeemably bad episode of Doctor Who. The Professor Hayter, we give to a bad episode of Doctor Who, but hey, at least they tried something. The Viscount Banger, which we give to the best of the best. The Fixed Point in Time, which is a show that we can't rate. It's beyond rating, usually for nearly reasons of nostalgia. And The Lady Cassandra, which is a paper-thin plot. But hey, at least it looks good, especially with a little moisturizing. All right, what do you say, Chris?
I say that many Doctor Who fans are deluding themselves and should be giving this a Fixed Point in Time. Like, that's what they're really rated. That's why Curse of Fenric is rated so high. I do want to briefly backtrack and say that maybe Clara is also responsible for the subsidence of the grave that the Doctor notices, because it's supposed to be a fresh grave, but the last date is in 1898. So, what the hell? So, yeah, Doctor's wrong about that. Anyway, sorry, we're not on the third question. We're on the fourth question. And yeah, this is, I mean, I really wish that I could find something redeeming here. I really wish that I could feel that they tried something new to enough of an extent to give it a Professor Hayter. But I don't. Yeah. All I see is a show that it's on its last legs, that is almost sabotaging itself at this point. A show on which everyone has internalized the notion that this is just a bad thing that's heading for cancellation. And they're bringing it about. So I just don't get a good feeling from it. I really wanted to, really was open to it, and I don't, and I'm sorry, but this is a big old stinky Ogron for me.
Yeah, you know what? I was going to be generous and sort of grade this on a curve big time, and I think I could pull out a Dalek from it, but I can't really do it. I can't, you know, I've after discussing it, I mean, you're not wrong is the problem. There's so many problems with this. And even on the curve, I can't recommend this as a good episode of Doctor Who. Certainly not to anyone who isn't familiar with the classic series. I would never say start with The Curse of Fenric. It's not definitely not, even if it were good, I wouldn't say start there. But it's kind of ruined. There are good ideas here. I want it to be better. I want this to be better. I like that it's set in World War II. I think the idea of the Ancient One, that again reflects Talons of Wang Chiang. I think McCoy is quite good in this, in that he's really playing that sort of master manipulator thing. So even though I'm almost convincing myself to reverse myself again, I've got to go with Professor Hayter. They tried something. but it's just ruined. It got ruined somewhere along the way, and maybe it's a budget thing, but I don't think it's just a budget thing. It's the Doctor Who always had a budget problem. Yeah. This is a lack of will thing.
Exactly. The budget is never an excuse. We know from the new show, like, they could have done Heaven Sent in the classic era. No problem at all. You know, and throwing all your budget into masks, terrible masks, the Hemovores, like, you didn't need to do that. It would have been much more creepy if they hadn't, like, transformed into vampire-like things. You know?
Yeah, I gotta say, the Curse of Fenric feels like the show's faith in itself has been shaken.
Yeah.
And it's being consumed by the Hemovore that is Michael Grade at the BBC at this point, you know?
yeah, absolutely. And it just, you know, even Ian Briggs himself, who purports to be very proud of Curse of Fenric, of having written it, said in his Doctor Who magazine interview, he was talking to Andrew Cartmell for this, and he says, obviously there are things that don't work terribly well, things in the script that aren't clear, but overall it was a decent idea. And even Cartmell himself didn't like the costumes, the Hemovores. So, like, even the people who are its biggest defenders and biggest boosters aren't really that into it when you drill down. So, yeah, I think we got to be honest and say, no, don't show this to your non-Doctor Who friends. Like, it's not even a so bad it's good. It's not, there's not a lot of fun to be had. It's not like Megloss.
Screens of Zolfathura.
Exactly. I can't say I'm giving a dollar because I had a fun time and I enjoyed how bad it was. Like, I didn't enjoy how bad this was in any way, shape, or form.
All right, folks. Well, you can disagree with us all you want. All you have to do is go to Spotify right now and vote for your rating on The Curse of Fenric. Is it a Dalek, Professor Hayter, Ogron, Viscount, Banger, Fixed Point in Time, Related Cassandra? Have your say. Vote now while Chris and I dive into the water of the randomizer.
That's right. I'm prepared to drown after this, if that's what it takes to get us out of here. So yes, the randomizer, two components. Peter's looking at the first one, the codex, the list of all Doctor Who stories in sequential order. Pete, how many stories have we left to do?
We have 195, if you can believe that.
Wow.
Ticking them off.
I can believe it. 195. So I plug those numbers into random.org, which is the executor, which uses true randomness, not algorithmic randomness, to generate random numbers. And I plug 1 and 195, and random.org will look around the atmosphere, and some ancient chess game will be played up there in ways that we are not privy to understanding. But before we do that, we like to give it challenges, the randomizer. I'll go first here because I want to say, get us out of here, because that do anything but McCoy, but I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say, because I know the randomizer likes the opportunity to mess with us, so I'm going to say, take us forward.
Okay.
And the randomizer knows that when I say that, I'm hoping for New Who.
Right.
But also, it could take us to survival, right? It could
or take the us TV to movie. Survival
or the TV movie.
And, there's not zero chance of that happening.
Exactly. So, you know, I feel like the randomizer won't be able to resist this, and we'll do this little stretch of McCoy in order, or we'll go to McGann and talk about the TV movie. Like, we'll just, whatever you want, randomizer, just take us forward.
Okay, that's good. Well, I admire the choice of a World War II setting, so I'm going to ask for that. And it doesn't necessarily have to be set in World War II or during those years. I think if there are robust references to the war in some way, that works. So that opens it up a little bit.
It does open it up to a lot of New Who, I would say, more than Old Who.
Definitely. Yeah. Though there is some references to World War II, particularly in the Pertwee era, where it was earthbound, and with UNIT in the 1970s/80s, where, you know, World War II was fairly recent history. So there could be stuff there.
Right. All right. Well, go forward and or give us World War II. These are our pleas. Please to the randomizer, please to the ancient randomizer that's been here from the dawn of time, or maybe it's from our future, we're not quite sure. Anyway, give me a countdown, we'll find out where we're going.
Here we go in 4, 3, 3, 2, 1.
Emergency temporal shift.
5. Wow.
5? No way. My goodness. It is the Reign of Terror.
Oh, wow. Okay. A lost story.
Yeah. Very missing. It's not entirely missing. I think there's a few episodes of this that survive.
Okay.
So we're going to be finding those. And there's probably, for the ones that are missing, the telesnap versions. Because I think there's quite a few of those that still survive in addition to the episodes that survive.
Indeed. And, oh boy, the randomizer just loves the history corner, doesn't it?
Yes. Good times. Wow.
To tell you all about the French Revolution and the terror that followed it, aren't I? Great.
I think we're going to have to get into the corner. It's going to be great, folks. Next time when we take on the Reign of Terror, one of the first pure historicals from the William Hartnell era. Guys, this has been Pull to Open. It is a podcast. Podcasts are great things to subscribe to or follow on whatever app you might be encountering us on, especially if it's YouTube. Subscriptions really help the show, and go ahead and turn on notifications so you'll get to know when we have new content. Oh, follow us on all the socials. We're at Pull to Open or Pull to Open 63. Go ahead and Google it. We always post lots of stuff. No, we don't. But we do post stuff, and we do post cool videos on a lot of networks, particularly TikTok and Instagram. And that's a good way to comment and let us know your thoughts on our thoughts.
Indeed. Let us know. Please, please let us. Don't be shy. If you love The Curse of Fenric, we really want to hear from you. We'll read out your opinion on the show. And yeah, we will see you next time in revolutionary France. And you know what, Pete? I feel like a march to the guillotine sounds pretty good right now.
Au revoir, everybody.